Hello and welcome to the History of Singapore, episode 27, The Living Buddha. David Saul Marshall was Singapore's first chief minister. A Jewish lawyer, he was appointed the compromise leader of the Labour Front less than a year before Singapore's 1955 elections. The Labour Front did not expect to win power, but an upset victory found Marshall leading the first locally formed government in April 1955. Just 14 months later, in June 1956, Marshall resigned as chief minister after failing to win full internal self-government at a constitutional conference in London. The David Marshall period, while short, is actually really instructive. First, it illustrates how history is comprised of multiple, overlapping perspectives, which can disagree with each other quite strongly while all being totally accurate. As I keep saying, history is an argument, not a narrative. Anyone who claims that there is only one official, authoritative version of events is being very foolish. Because if nothing else, the truth always comes out eventually. But more than that, it's because there's just so many different perspectives from so many different people on the same events, and David Marshall illustrates this. If you read only English language sources like official documents, the Straits Times and Lee Kuan Yew's autobiography, then you get an image of the David Marshall period as being really turbulent and unstable. Marshall's government is called quote-unquote weak and quote-unquote soft, capitulating to subversive elements and allowing communists free reign. Lee Kuan Yew, in his autobiography, of course, takes this a step further, and he links Marshall's principles of justice and democracy with chaos and instability. Lee appears to say, look, if you want democracy, you also get instability. He uses the Marshall government as a instructive contrast to the relative peace and stability created by the repressions and detentions of Lee's own government. So Lee accepts that Marshall established abstract principles of democracy and justice and demonstrated ideals and values, but he argues that Marshall had little practical impact. Indeed, Lee writes rather condescendingly of Marshall and describes him as, among other things, and I quote here, naive. But of course, the English language perspective is just one set of perspectives, and a minority one. If you look at the Chinese language sources, and remember, those who spoke Chinese as a first language comprised over 70% of the island back then. If you look at the Chinese language sources, we see a very different Marshall. And that's the Marshall we're going to focus on today. But second, as Lee himself admits, Marshall was able to establish certain principles and practices. As the first chief minister, Marshall had enormous influence over the conduct of the office and how it was run. Marshall established precedents which his successors had to follow. He established expectations among the public that his successors strained to reach. Marshall's courage and conviction expanded the scope and the power and the influence of the office of chief minister. And this is particularly impressive since the British did not want the office to actually exist. So with this in mind, let's pick up the story from where we left off last week. David Marshall found himself the leader of a shaky coalition of pro-Labour anti-colonial politicians called the Labour Front. They didn't expect to win, but left-wing pro-Labour parties won in a landslide. The people made their judgment clear, and as I've said this before, for this reason, the 1955 election would be Singapore's only free and fair general election. Now, if you read the English language sources, the victory of the left-wing parties was a massive shock. But if you read the Chinese press, it wouldn't have been a surprise. While the Chinese press avoided endorsing any specific politicians, their editorials and the readers' letters show a clear respect for David Marshall. They believed that he understood the Chinese and felt that the Labour Front would represent Chinese working-class interests better than the businessmen of the right-wing Progressive Party and Democratic Party. And so when the Labour Front emerged as the strongest party of 10 seats and the PAP won 3 of the 4 seats it contested, the Straits Times acted like the sky was falling in. But the Chinese press were more like, well, they raised their eyebrows and said, oh, that's great. See, the British had only been dimly aware of these tremendous disruptions that were influencing the lives of the Chinese working class. They were not prepared for the result of the election. They had expected that the Progressive Party, stimulated by a small, radical opposition, would guide Singapore to a peaceful and gradual transition to internal self-government, leaving economic and defence interests undisturbed. Instead, they now had to deal with David Marshall. So as the Labour Front had the biggest representation, Marshall was summoned by Governor Sir John Nicoll to form the next government. Marshall formed the government with the support of a mixture of elected, ex officio and nominated members. And so they numbered a total of 18 in an assembly of 32. So from the very beginning, his position was very precarious. It was a left-wing minority government, forced to work with sceptical British colonial officials, dependent on ex officio nominated members for their majority, facing an opposition that was almost evenly split between an extreme left-wing, a conservative right-wing, and independents. So no matter what Marshall did, someone was going to criticize him severely, someone was going to hate him, someone was going to try and block him. But Marshall rose to the challenge. He strove to fulfill his party's election manifesto and refused to be intimidated by Governor Nicoll, who also had a very strong, obstinate personality. The two clashed early on. Nicoll believed that the leader of the Legislative Assembly would only be Minister of Commerce and Industry, but Marshall would not be browbeaten. He insisted on making the office of Chief Minister a full-time appointment and created a separate Commerce and Industry Ministry. Nicoll refused to allocate a separate Chief Minister's office until Marshall threatened to set up his desk under a tree in front of the Secretariat, and then miraculously, they managed to find a tiny office for Marshall. Like Harry Potter, they gave Marshall the office under the staircase. It was a tiny cubicle, maybe 12 by 14 feet, but Marshall gave it dignity. Marshall was completely within his rights to demand an office. In March, when the colonial authorities still expected the election to produce a conservative, cooperative leader, a government spokesman had explained that the chief minister, not the chief secretary, would lead the government and would have a status similar to that of the British Prime Minister. Now that the combative Marshall was chief minister, this was conveniently forgotten, and they said, oh no, only the Minister of Commerce and Industry would be the leader, that's it. So they sought to reduce him. And even after Marshall was elected, and even after the top British officials agreed to accept him as chief minister, a lot of the British establishment resisted him. The British kept putting him too low on protocol lists. You know, it was hugely insulting to Marshall. And Marshall personally didn't care, of course, but he knew such acts were an insult to the people of Singapore. He was the elected chief minister, the chosen representative of the people of Singapore. And so any insult to the chief minister was an insult to the people of Singapore. And so time and time again, Marshall found himself placed too far down on protocol lists. At one point, he was below even a junior British naval officer. And so Marshall would simply refuse to participate. He threatened to go home until his office, not himself, but his office, was properly recognized. But Marshall only wanted to ensure proper recognition and respect. He turned down other things which he saw as unnecessary extravagances, like a proposal to buy Coleman House, which was at No. 3 Coleman Street, to be the official chief minister's residence. This huge mansion was where the Peninsula Hotel and Shopping Centre is today. So he turned this down. He said, no, I'll just live at home. And this restraint is rare among even other Commonwealth Prime Ministers. It's even rarer among other national leaders. And it's even rarer among other Malayan Menteri Besar. But, you know, in Singapore, no Prime Minister has ever bothered to renovate the official residence or rebuild it. Or buy something new. There's an official residence, but it's just Sri Temasek just sits there. They don't use it. So like Marshall, they all live at home. Marshall also famously inaugurated the Meet the People sessions and the Public Advisory Bureau. During his election campaign, Marshall made a seemingly rash election promise that he would devote one day a week to meet the people of his constituency directly, face to face, to hear their problems and their suggestions for improving government. And after he was elected, he reiterated this. And the objective, he said later, was, quote, that the people should realize that this is their government, and these arrogant civil servants were their servants, in truth and in fact, unquote. And for cases which needed further assistance, he created the Public Advisory Bureau. So the Meet the People session survived to this day, while the Public Advisory Bureau itself closed after Marshall resigned as Chief Minister, but various bodies duplicating its functions continue to exist. And more importantly, the principle that politicians are servants of the people, that civil servants are servants of the people, that people should have direct access to their elected officials. All these principles were introduced by David Marshall, and politicians today still have to pay lip service to them. And so, through force of personality, through dint of his ability, and by the fact that there were so few very capable men in government, and by arguing for the broadest possible interpretation of the Constitution with regards to his powers, Marshall was able to carve out a role for himself and his office against the will of the British. The British wanted a manager, not a leader. They wanted stability and continuity, not a people's revolution. They wanted their own interests to be protected, not for a chief minister to fight on behalf of his people. But Marshall was none of the former, all of the latter. And we can see this in particular how Marshall handled the first two major challenges of his leadership. These were made trickier by the fact that they were tied to the two biggest issues of concern to the working class and non-English speaking community, and they are labour rights and vernacular education. Under the British, the Hockley bus strike in April 1955 would have been forcibly suppressed by the police, with the strikers arrested and the pickets cleared, regardless of who was right or wrong or whether the workers were genuinely being oppressed. And as we know, as I've discussed in the case of Hockley, the workers were morally in the right. The Hockley Bus Company had concluded an agreement with them and then reneged on the agreement. And Marshall, instead of sending the police in to forcibly clear the strike, tried to mediate. Can you imagine how life-changing it would be when, after years of living in fear, the police don't show up, and instead you're told there's going to be mediation, and not just by anyone, but by the chief minister and a lawyer who was already famous for defending the downtrodden and the oppressed. Imagine how liberating it is, how exciting it is. And so, in May 1955, under pressure from Marshall, the management of the bus company conceded almost all of the strikers' demands. As I mentioned in the episode on Hockley, there was a great division in how this outcome was seen. Governor Nicholl disparaged the agreement in a telegram to his boss, the British Secretary of State for the Colonies, Alan Lennox Boyd. The Straits Times condemned the settlement as, quote, unconditional surrender, unquote. But the Chinese community were ecstatic. The Chinese newspapers declared that justice had finally been served. And this carried into the second issue. The strikers had drawn sympathy from Chinese school students who had turned out in force to support the picket. The trade unions had supported the students in the National Service protest the previous year, and they had a common cause against years of colonial discrimination. During the riot, several students were arrested and three Chinese schools were closed. The outraged students barricaded themselves in Zhongzheng High School. Nicholl warned that another climb down by Marshall could weaken the administration, and he offered to take full responsibility for the use of reserve powers to evict the students, i.e. send the troops in after them. But Marshall refused this deception, saying it would be dishonest on his part. This principle is, of course, in stark contrast to Lee Kuan Yew, who would later repeatedly use the British as cover, by publicly blaming the British while privately ordering the detention without trial of his own comrades. But for Marshall, the issue was not just honesty, it was responsibility. If you make a decision, if you take up a policy, then you have to take responsibility for it. You don't hide behind someone else. You don't hide under someone else's coattails. So what Marshall did was he appointed an all-party education committee to look into the problem of Chinese education. This was a marked departure from colonial policy, which had not ever bothered to consult the opinion of the Chinese-speaking community in their formulation of education policy. And the committee immediately recommended to Marshall that the schools be reopened, and he did so, despite intense pressure from the British colonial officials not to. And the Chinese community again cheered, declaring that it was a, quote, testimony of the Labour Front government's far-sighted democratic spirit, unquote. And in particular, they quoted his statement that Chinese students were, quote, sick children who should be nursed and not whipped, unquote, as proof of an enlightened attitude. Within the Chinese community, Marshall emerged from the Hockley bus strike and the subsequent student strike with his standing enhanced. His moderation and attempt to mediate between the various parties positioned him as an honest broker who could negotiate with his ministers and with the British on behalf of the people. The riots were generally seen as not Marshall's fault, but a symptom of a problem he inherited from the colonial regime. The Nanyang Shangpao reminded its readers, quote, "It must be realized that such troubles are to be traced to the old system of government, the discontent with which must sooner or later break out. To put the blame for this on the indulgence and indecision of the new government is guilty of shallowness in perception," unquote. And the Hsinchu Jitpo and Nanfang Evening Post newspapers concurred, gave similar opinions. Strikes and riots had been ruthlessly suppressed under the old government, which was, quote, "rotten to the core," unquote. And the daunting task of the new government was, quote, "to turn rottenness into something wonderful," unquote. Of course, a minority of the Chinese press disagreed on the root cause of the situation. Their viewpoint was represented by the Chongqing Jitpo, which blamed manipulation by communists and by the PAP. It argued that the PAP was exploiting workers and students to further its political aims, which, you know, there is a grain of truth there. However, it concurred with the other newspapers in supporting Marshall's handling of the situation. Naturally, the Straits Times saw Marshall as weak and capitulating to the communists. The view of British colonial officials was much more complicated. As a result of Marshall's actions, the British were shaken out of their complacency. Singapore's government could no longer be counted on to be docile and compliant. This provoked a massive debate within Whitehall, in London, as to how to respond. Despite his belief in the use of force, Governor Nicoll felt he could not overrule Marshall without provoking a constitutional crisis and demonstrating that the British had introduced a new constitution on bad faith. Marshall would be forced to resign. Fresh elections would then likely return an even more rabidly anti-colonial and uncooperative government. And his boss in London, Colonial Secretary Lennox Boyd, concurred. And Marshall was fully aware of this, so he was actually apt to threaten to resign in order to achieve his objectives. Sir Robert Black, Nicoll's successor as governor, would later complain about being blackmailed by these threats. Quote, "Suddenly he would say, 'I resign.' And then you then had to have another election, and it wasn't a decision which was Marshall's or Lee Kuan Yew's, but the fellow up at Government House who had to navigate from the bridge unobtrusively," unquote. So imagine that. Black is complaining that the elected leader of government is making life difficult for him, the unelected colonial civil servant. This paternalistic attitude is typical of the British government mentality that Marshall detested. So this view of Marshall as an uncooperative and irresponsible leader whose administration might fall and be replaced by a more extreme government, this view gave rise to two contradictory schools of thought among British policymakers. On the one hand, it was suggested that if a crisis could be avoided through minor concessions, these were worth making in order to prevent an even more left-wing administration from taking power. On the other hand, it was argued that Marshall's government was bound to eventually fall whatever additional powers he was granted. And so any concessions, any greater powers granted now, would ultimately be inherited by a more hostile administration. A refusal to offer concessions would hasten Marshall's departure. Although the immediate consequence of this seemed likely to be further unrest, in the longer term, Britain had a good chance of finding a more moderate and amenable negotiating partner. Colonial Secretary Lennox Boyd thought long and hard, but eventually decided, better the devil you know than the devil you don't. And so he authorized the requisite concessions to Marshall, which confirmed Marshall's interpretation of the Constitution. When we return, more about Marshall's battle against the British. As Marshall's government entered its third month, it was already recognized that Marshall was overworked. As I mentioned, there were scarce few capable men in Marshall's government. The British, in their own evaluations, only rated Marshall and Lim Yew Hock as having any talent and capability. perhaps this was unfair, but the fact was that Marshall was doing the lion's share of the work. He would routinely work late into the night before returning early the next morning. He kept this up for months, until in January 1956, Marshall would be admitted to Singapore General Hospital for what amounted to exhaustion and was ordered to rest by the doctor. And in July 1955, you could already have foreseen this. And so, partly because of this, and partly also the quell dissent from within his own party from those passed over for ministerial posts, on 9th July 1955, Marshall requested the appointment of 4 additional assistant ministers. Marshall expected his request to be met, but Governor Black felt this was excessive given that there were already 10 ministers in an assembly of 32 members and would only agree to 2 assistant ministers. Marshall argued that on issues about where the governor was obliged to consult the chief minister, he was also obliged to accept the chief minister's advice. The constitution was ambiguous on the point, and its wording implied Marshall's interpretation. Black, however, argued that this represented a departure from the existing practice, which could only be affected by amending the constitution. Marshall threatened to resign if the principle was not conceded. The Chinese press and readers were strongly supportive in the issue over the appointment of additional ministers. They agreed that he was overworked. Indeed, a Nanfang Evening Post editorial in support was titled, quote, "The Chief Minister is too busy," unquote. Public opinion was divided as to whether the appointments were promotions for talented individuals, due to patronage, or to actually meet a genuine need, but regardless agreed that the elected leader of the people had the right to appoint his ministers. His threat to resign was seen by the Chinese press as a principled stand. Of course, it was seen by the Straits Times as hysterical grandstanding. Amongst the British, opinion was again divided on how to handle the situation. Lennox Boyd asked Marshall to wait until August 1955, when he would arrive in Singapore on a scheduled trip, to resolve the issue. On 25th July, Marshall called a special meeting of the Legislative Assembly. It passed a resolution supporting his position and asserted that the time had come for Singapore to be given a new, fully self-governing constitution. This vote was welcomed enthusiastically by the Chinese press as well, which argued that the events of the previous few months demonstrated the strength of anti-colonial fervour among the public. Lennox Boyd arrived in Singapore on 31st July, and after 2 tense days of discussion, Lennox Boyd accepted the advice of his local officials and agreed the governor would henceforth act on the chief minister's advice. Marshall was victorious and his reputation grew. The Sin Chiu Jitpo called him, quote, "full of fighting spirit," unquote, and, quote, "a great warrior," unquote, while the Nanyang Shangpao praised him as, quote, "a worthy elected chief minister because of his hard work and perseverance and his devotion to the people despite having no real political power," unquote. The Chongqing Jitpo printed a list of the small but numerous ways in which Marshall had helped ordinary people during his tenure, headlined, quote, "We need more Marshalls," unquote, and it called him a living Buddha. The downside to his victory, however, was that expectations of Marshall had moved from merely social and economic rights and were now almost inextricably tied to the advancement of political rights and self-determination. But having already plucked the low-hanging fruit, opposition to his political agenda would only increase from now on. Signs were also emerging that Marshall, having successfully navigated his way through a series of difficult trials, was beginning to get carried away in his belief that he could wring further concessions out of the British. He told a delegation of visitors from Selangor that if Singapore could not achieve independence within an expected time, he would, quote, "throw away his briefcase and not hold on to his portfolio," unquote. This was the first recorded hint that he would resign if he failed to get significant concessions from the British. And the British cabinet regarded Marshall with great unease. They felt that they had been pushed too far and too fast. They criticised Colonial Secretary Lennox Boyd's apparent readiness to concede to nationalist pressure. There was general agreement that it was too soon to talk of revising the constitution and that Britain should, quote, avoid the appearance of precipitate retreat under pressure, unquote. They refused to allow Lennox Boyd to offer talks in London the following year, which, quote, would be comprehensive and include the timing of possible future constitutional advances, unquote. Instead, their official message to Marshall ambiguously invited a, quote, representative delegation from Singapore to consider the situation in the light of a year's working of the Constitution, unquote. So, the talks that were offered were never intended to be about self-government, let alone independence. But Marshall interpreted the message differently, referring to the message as a most generous concession and adding that, quote, the very first item on the agenda is going to be the question of a date for complete self-government, unquote. So, this period, August to December 1955, was the apogee of the Marshall government. Marshall led a trade delegation to Jakarta, where he succeeded in easing trade restrictions. And this immediately improved Singapore's embattled and trade-dependent economy. It was eagerly welcomed and his mission was praised by the Chinese press. Marshall was given great credit as a diplomat and a statesman. Marshall also attempted to repeal the emergency regulations but failed when the Federation of Malaya, fearing complications for its own emergency operations, prevailed against this. Black offered to take responsibility for the regulations by reimposing them using his reserve powers once Marshall had revoked them. Marshall rejected this suggestion as hypocritical and went public with it. He did accept that communism was still a problem, and so in the end, as a compromise, most of the regulations were reintroduced as the Preservation of Public Security Ordinance, or PPSO. The sections of the Chinese community who were unenthusiastic about the PPSO saw this outcome as a manifestation of continued British control as opposed to any real failing by Marshall. A minority, of course, supported the PPSO as a necessary guard against communist subversion via the trade unions, or the PAP, and they congratulated Marshall on his courage. The PPSO, of course, had to be renewed every year by the Legislative Assembly or would automatically lapse. And Marshall, with his Minister of Labour, Lim Yew Hock, also forced through a labour ordinance that introduced a 44-hour week, 28 days paid sick leave a year, 1 week's paid annual leave, and the minimum rate of time and a half for overtime work, and enhanced maternity benefits for female workers. And this represented light years of progress over the existing labour ordinances. And so as the calendar turned over to 1956, David Marshall's popularity was at an all-time high. Through sheer force of his ability and personality, he had forced the British to make major concessions, scaring the British cabinet so much that they outright refused to allow the colonial secretary to offer any more. He had moved so fast that he was now talking about achieving independence. Before Marshall, independence was something people had envisioned as maybe 10 or 15 years down the road. But now, just 6 months later, Marshall was saying he would go to London the next year and win self-government. For Singapore's nationalists, it was a heady, intoxicating time when anything seemed possible. Freedom seemed suddenly, for the first time, tangible. And therein lay the problem, for Marshall had moved so far, so fast, that it would not be possible for him to meet expectations. He had pushed the situation as far as it could go, perhaps further than anyone had any right to expect. But the British cabinet felt it had already gone way too far, and they made it clear they would not consider anything further. Whether he knew it or not, Marshall was walking into a brick wall. All of that will be covered next week as we discuss the 1956 constitutional talks in London and Marshall's subsequent resignation. For today, I just want to conclude by recapping my two main points. First, about perspectives. Depictions of David Marshall in the English and Chinese newspapers in Singapore seem to portray two different people. The English newspapers in particular, the pro-British Straits Times, criticize him relentlessly for being irresponsible and weak, while the Chinese newspapers hailed him as a great principled hero. And this divide reflects Marshall's vociferous anti-colonial, pro-labour, democratic instincts which found colonialism personally abhorrent. Despite leading a minority government, Marshall achieved more for the downtrodden labouring people of Singapore in 14 months than the previous 136 years of British rule. It included laws ensuring multilingualism in the Legislative Assembly, enfranchisement via an equitable form of citizenship, workers' rights, free legal aid for the poor, and the kickstarting of the Malayanization of the civil service. Through Meet the People sessions, Marshall established the important principle that the role of government was to listen and help its people. And secondly, and most importantly, he demonstrated that principled democratic leadership could force the British to concede power. This went a long way to removing the fear of British power that had characterized previous relationships, previous exchanges between Singapore's people, particularly the Chinese-speaking community and the British. Marshall's accomplishments came despite laboring under extremely difficult circumstances. His government was crippled by a lack of talent, divided by infighting among self-serving politicians. His scope for pursuing his goals was restricted by the constitution, by challenges from the opposition, and British reluctance. Despite these crippling factors, Marshall soldiered on to the point where he actually collapsed out of exhaustion. Admiration and respect for Marshall cut across class and political and ideological lines in Singapore. In just over 6 months, Marshall completely transformed how people saw themselves, their country, and the British Empire and their place in it. He gave people courage. He gave people pride. He gave people hope. He inspired people to believe in better for themselves, for their families, their community, their country. He made us stand tall, stand upright. He gave us the ability to look the British in the eye and not back down. He was the living Buddha. As always, if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, please email me at thehistoryofsingapore@gmail.com or visit my webpage at thehistoryofsingapore.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit Patreon, patreon.com/pjthumb. Thank you very much and see you next week.